Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University.
Welcome to our show today. I am Kevin Ugarteche, producer and graduate assistant for the Gortney Institute. Dr. Ross McCullough, the founder of the Gortney Institute and Wei Angel Chair of Economics. Dr. Justin Clark, the Menard Family Professor of Philosophy and Ethics. Finally, Dr. Peter Jacobson, the Gortney Professor of Economic Education and Research.
All right, so we thought we'd talk about mental health awareness and policy, certainly something that has changed, I think, dramatically, even over 20, 30 years. I'm 52, so been I think, some real strides in people being more comfortable at, working through the issues that they have in regard to their mental health. And but we couldn't help but think about analyzing the policies that are coming down the pipeline and how that impacts us in a variety of ways. So, Justin, what did you have to say about this? Or you found some literature or something?
I had recently read a tweet that had an excerpt from Abigail Schreier's new book, which is called Bad Therapy. And I mean, the book itself has to do with the negative effects certain aspects of the way we currently psychologize children and the way psychiatric and psychological therapy tries to nudge children to act, and that this has a detrimental effect on children. And if anyone recognizes Abigail Schreier's name, she wrote a book a couple of years ago called Irreversible Damage about the rapid increase in transgenderism among school age girls. And she noted that this seemed to follow the same patterns that eating disorders followed in the 90s, that it looked like a social contagion. And that's an excellent book. I would recommend any of our listeners to read it. So once again, it's called Irreversible Damage. The author is Abigail Schreier, but her most recent book, Bad Therapy, takes a wider view, and it says, well, let's just look at the way psychiatry is deployed when we're dealing with children. And she describes something that happened to her son. In one of the chapters, she said her son came home from sleepaway camp over the summer and he had a stomach ache and it didn't go away. And so she took him to an urgent care clinic and they said, just it's probably dehydration, go see your regular provider. So she goes in to, this was still at the urgent care clinic. And then at the urgent care clinic, they say, before you leave, it's probably just dehydration, but before you leave, would you mind giving us some privacy so I can give your son a mental health screening? And she says that after a second, she realized the privacy that the person was requesting was privacy between the doctor and her son, like for her to leave the room. And she asked she asked to see the questionnaire, which was something that was distributed by the National Institute of Mental Health, which is a federal government agency. And she says, here is the complete unedited list of the questions the nurse had planned to ask my 12-year-old in private, without me there, after we had come in for a stomach ache. The questions are, in the past few weeks, have you wished you were dead? 2, in the past few weeks, have you felt that you and your family, or that you or your family would be better off if you were dead? 3, in the past few weeks, have you had thoughts about killing yourself? 4, have you ever tried to kill yourself? If yes, how? When? 5, are you having thoughts about killing yourself right now? If yes, please describe. And when the nurse asked her to leave the room, he wasn't going off script. That is what the National Institute of Health, Mental Health, that's the script that the nurses are supposed to follow before they ask these questions. And I find this like really, really alarming for a bunch of reasons. And I thought maybe we could talk about what we think has gone wrong, because I think like at least seven things have gone wrong, but that this is absolutely terrible policy. And it reflects something that I think is just kind of running amok in our culture right now. And that is, it seems like mental health policy has infected every single aspect of our lives. So things to talk about here, like this exact situation, I think we should talk about, like, you know, one of the problems that I have and other people in this room may have raised too, is like with our things that have to be included in our syllabi, like what you're supposed to read for the semester, which now has a page full of mental health stuff on it. And I actually, not only do I not think this is good, I actually think it's like also really bad for mental health, period. So having just said that, I don't know if you guys have any reactions.
I had one reaction that is a little odd maybe, but when you read those questions, I agree, they're alarming. They sound like questions that would be for a 12-year-old who has already been diagnosed with something or has gotten into trouble or arrested or, you know, have been found attempting to harm themselves, like a higher level of questions that somehow now got substituted in. Well, we should ask everybody these questions. I don't know if that, you know, is true or not, but they just seem so direct and issues you would do with somebody who has already showed signs that they are thinking about that, or they're kind of going down that path, rather than just some ordinary average, you know, 12-year-old.
You would think even somebody who was brought in, and even somebody who was 12 and who was brought in, who was maybe caught really trying to do some kind of self-harm, you would think one of the first questions would be something like, tell me about yourself. How do you feel about yourself? Maybe after that long discussion, saying something like, it sounds like you're thinking about harming yourself. Could you tell me more about that? Yeah. Instead of the first question being, have you thought of killing yourself?
Yeah, I think mental health is a tricky field, because everybody kind of knows that people can have like mental issues, but in reality, we don't really know what that looks like. So even things as seemingly well understood as depression, up until, you know, 10 years ago, people used to think depression is a chemical imbalance in the brains, and that you had just have like the wrong balance of chemicals. And if you correct that balance, then the depression can go away. But the literature found that that's not actually the case, that there's not a chemical imbalance that we can see, at least not the original one that people thought existed, that's correctable in any sense. So mental health is tricky because it seems obviously real, but it isn't tangible like most of our physiological issues are. And so that leads us to this weird place of, I think, too many experts and too many cooks with too many like differing ideas. And it's not obvious to me that there is one answer to how to deal with mental health, which makes addressing it very difficult. I think maybe one of the things that Justin is, not that you're trying to get at anything here, but one of the things that you're opening up is like, maybe this sort of question could like plant seeds in people's heads, right? Like maybe someone who didn't think about that before and is now going to go home and like think about it, right? And that could be harmful and damaging. Now, do I think that's going to happen to everybody? No, I don't think so. But I also can't rule out that it would happen to somebody. And so it seems like our first rule in medicine is do no harm. And that's really easy when you're doing surgery. It's pretty hard when you're doing mental health assessment and fixing to make sure that you're not doing any harm, especially since we don't know what triggers this stuff. So I'm pretty wary of the increased heightened focus on mental health for this reason. Is I think that a lot of it ends up being quackery in terms of the fixes. I don't think we have a good one size fits all. I'm not even sure there is a one size fits all. That's the difficult part.
Well, and I think everyone has mental issues. I mean, I think it's part of being human, in my opinion. And maybe since this is our faith in economics, maybe it's part of sin being in the world. But I mean, I think we all have on a spectrum some levels of mental issues, bad days, you know, whatever you want to call them. And so I think that's also where it gets tricky, where some people are really dealing with, you know, some serious mental issues, and others are just dealing with the humdrum mental issues. And so as that spectrum, you know, where's the line? And like you just said, it's not a very easy line to draw.
Let me run off a couple of things Peter said. The first is that, Peter's right. I am getting at that I think this is harmful, and that this does plant a seed in a very impressionable young mind. We know if you look at some of the package or some of the warnings that come with some psychiatric medications, one of those warnings that will show up is suicidal ideation, right? Which mm-hmm. means it gives somebody the idea of committing suicide as a possible solution to the problem, where previously that hadn't been an idea, right? And it seems like that is exactly, explicitly what this questionnaire does. But you're in, yeah. Oh, you have a stomach ache? Have you thought about killing yourself by any chance? Like yeah. To a 12-year-old, you might go like, oh, wait, is that how some people get rid of their stomach aches? I mean, and God forbid somebody's in there for somebody who is actually mentally troubled, who is getting this, getting peppered with these increasingly really intense questions by somebody in a coat, in a lab coat. We already know that people are more likely to agree to what somebody says when they're in a position of authority. This seems like it's obviously a case that would result in, at least on the margins, increased suicidal ideation. If you're giving this questionnaire out willy-nilly to people to come in, or even people that might even be at risk, if you're just asking them these five really pointed and increasingly pointed questions.
Yeah.
And to Peter's other point about, you know, first doing no harm, I agree with Peter. This is what we should be doing in medicine. I think maybe Peter would agree with me here, maybe not. I think this is a case where it's actually easy to not do harm by, like, literally not asking these questions. Like, this seems like this is an obvious case where this is doing harm. I agree that a lot of people who came up with these probably thought they were, you know, helping, but it's very easy to say that, this will help, you know, five cases, and just ignoring the problems that this is going to cause in a bunch of other cases that wouldn't have been problem cases otherwise.
Yeah, for them to either think or assume that they're harmless for the people who don't need it. Well, this is getting close to a break. I got to tell you a little story. I think one of the things that bothers me about this is having the parents leave or asking them to even leave. Because I think some parents might just, follow the rules. They say to leave and then go away. Well, my son Carter was 7 years old or so, and he got the chair pulled out from him from school and went down and just smacked the back of his head really hard at school. And so we ended up going to the emergency room because he didn't know his phone number, kind of some of the concussion-ish type of stuff. And so turns out he came around, and we were getting close to one part of the evaluation or towards the end. And the nurse, Dana and I were both in the room with Carter, and the nurse just kind of out of nowhere says, Carter, does anybody at home hurt you? And I'm like, oh my gosh. And he says, yes. And I'm about ready to jump across the room and strangle him. I'm like, no, don't say anything.
You hurt him?
And he's like, that hurt him. Anybody at home, that hurts him. Across the room. Yeah, and then I'm ready to jump across the room and say, you're going to get us put away. Yeah. And so he says, yes. And he's like, who's that? My dog, Sterling. Sometimes hurts me. And I'm like, we just breathed a sigh of relief, not knowing where that question was going. But my point is, having the parents in the room is a big deal. So at least, even if something offensive or whatever that you need to work through, you know the exact context of how it came to be, and you can have that debriefing at home when you go, if you end up getting questions, especially like that. So I think that element of it kind of bothered me as well. So take a short break here and get back to continuing on how some other issues of how mental health policy might affect us. Of course, we're not psychologists. We like to, we are doctors, but it's not of the medical type. So we'll give our two cents on policy as we come back from break. We'll be back in a bit.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gortney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today. Okay, so we're back, and you know, there's a lot of things that have changed here, even at the university, in terms of excused absences, and certainly I've seen that here in my full-time work in Ottawa. I came in 2011, but long before that, I was dealing with people who were in the hospital for an injury, so physical harm of some sort, and it seems increasingly that I needed a mental health day or whatever, some sort of thing that from a policy standpoint at the university is something that we excuse and, might have to make up a test, let's say, or something if the test is Friday and there was the various university excused absences. And so I think there's a lot to talk about on what we think the impacts of that will be. Is that going to be overall better for the United States that people, are grasping onto this mental health awareness and really thinking about that a lot, so to speak, for that's almost a pun, I guess, or what the other trade-offs will be. So, Justin, you want to talk a little bit more on those trade-offs and not only trade-offs, but physical and spiritual and mental health?
Well, I'd like to talk about the difference between what we think about as physical disease and what we mean when we talk about mental health. Because for a lot of human history, these two things were kind of woven together. We just had diseases and there were different, a lot of people thought that spiritual ailments caused certain physical diseases. And then around the mid-1500s, we start to see what's now called the germ theory of disease, right? I think the guy who came up with it, Girolamo Fracassato, butchering his name, he was one of the first persons to write that there were these kind of invisible disease seeds that were floating around. And if you got one of the disease seeds, then you got the disease. And now we know we live in a world where we think that, viruses and bacteria cause disease when we're talking about things like strep or COVID-19, right? What happens when you think you have strep? You go in, you get a strep test, and they scrub the back of your throat or whatever, or the inside of your nostril, and they test it, and they go, these symptoms that you're having, we know what's causing them. It's this pathogen, right? This germ. And the germ theory of disease has been really, really useful in helping us identify and treat some physical ailments. And so some of the things that we used to characterize as disease, and the word dis-ease just means like, you are You're not living easily. It's
really, I never thought about that.
Dis-ease. No, you're in a state of dis-ease, right? you can be in a state of dis-ease because one of your limbs is gangrenous and is about to fall off.
Oh, right? Yeah.
We can maybe treat that gangrene with things like penicillin. Now, in the 20th century, I mean, from kind of Freud onward, where we have developed this taxonomy of what we now know of as like mental diseases, there is this view that mental diseases must somehow be like physical diseases. And that's why we say things like mental illness, right? And it's this view that, well, there's something going on in the mind that's like what's happening when a germ gets into the body. And so this is the view that I think Peter was talking about earlier when he said, this view that depression is imbalance of chemicals that are going on in your brain, whether it's neurotransmitters or whatever. There are some cases where we say this person looks like they have a mental illness, or this person looks, they're not developing correctly. And sometimes we've been able to isolate a genetic or germ that we think causes that. So a good example would be something like Down syndrome, like where we know that Down syndrome is caused by, instead of the usual two, there being an three or an extra chromosome on whatever number it is, like 23 or something like that, right? It's not like Down syndrome didn't exist before we figured that out. We said, here's this thing. We suspect that there's a particular cause of it. Now, a lot of the things that we think of as mental illnesses, things like depression, maybe anxiety, it's tempting to think that, does somebody have the anxiety bug? But in the same way that, you know, if we want to figure out whether someone has strep, they can have the symptoms of strep and we take the test and we figure out they actually don't have strep. They just have the symptoms. Something else must be causing those symptoms. Or they could have strep and be asymptomatic, right? But we can't do that with depression. We can't just take a brain scan of somebody and go, actually you're depressed, right? It says right on it, you tested positive for depression. That's not the way it works. And so this leads, there's a famous book by a dissident psychologist, Thomas Schaas, who's a Hungarian dissident, called The Myth of Mental Illness. And his claim isn't that there's nothing wrong with people that we think are mental illness. It's that mental illness as a category is a bad analogy to physical illness. We should just say that some people have a lot of trouble living, and we should try to figure out how to get them, how to treat them so that they can live better. But his claim is that mental illness isn't an analog of physical illness. There's no actual germ or specific imbalance that we can identify, like there's the depression imbalance, there's all these other things. It's just people have trouble living. And some people have a lot more trouble living than other people do. This doesn't mean they're faking it. They're not faking it. Schaas would say these people aren't faking it. They need help. But this analogy isn't doing them any favors, making us treat them in ways that aren't really helpful to them. And this, I think, leads back to what Russ said earlier when he said, look, everybody has kind of trouble living, or everybody has some mental problems. And the reason I went through this whole rigmarole is that if you are wedded to this idea of what we now call mental illnesses being some kind of diagnosable imbalance that's in principle treatable, when we figure out which part of your your humors are not in balance compared to the ideal human brain that we have over here, then we can pump you full of chemicals and get you, you know, ideally balanced. If we're wedded to that, then that would explain the kind of taxonomical explosion that we've seen in the past 50 years about what counts as a mental illness. And therefore, what needs to be treated. And it's this kind of taxonomical explosion. And you can read accounts of what goes on when people are re-editing the DSM, which is the actual manual that physicians use to diagnose mental illnesses. It increases every year and it expands because we have more and more people who will say, well, here's kind of the problem that I have living. And we go, okay, well, let's give it a medical diagnosis. And then it's no longer, you know, a problem of living or something that might be a common feature of humanity. You know, I think the Greeks would say something like a kind of depression in the sense of like looking at the vastness of the universe and your own insignificance in it. I mean, I think the Greeks would say that's just an inevitable part of being human. It's a symptom of being human. But now we can diagnose that as depression type D and give you a pill that means you never have to look into the abyss or whatever. And so I think that this is just bad. And that's the end of my TED talk.
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue with mental illness is that unlike physical illness, a lot of times the symptoms are the root problem. And so with physical illness, if you have the flu, the root problem is you have a virus in your body and the virus needs to go away. The symptoms are evidence of the fact that you have the virus and they maybe cause problems for you, but the root problem is the virus. Same with cancer. You know, the symptoms of cancer, you know, the pain that it can cause and the attendant like issues aren't really the problem. The problem is you have these cells that keep reproducing and they won't stop. Even if you take them out, they keep going. And so mental illness is kind of the opposite, I think, in a lot of cases where like if someone is like feeling very depressed or lethargic or something like that, like the problem is they're depressed and lethargic. There might not be a root cause other than the thing itself. That doesn't mean that there isn't. Maybe there is, and we don't know what that root cause is yet. Like, that's possible, but it's not obviously the case that that's true. I think for some mental illnesses, we know this to be true. So, for example, I think people who are manic depressive, like, we know that something about their condition can be treated with, like, lithium. And that's something we can pretty consistently find. So there's probably something physiologically that giving them lithium helps them overcome that this is no longer a problem. But that's not true necessarily about every mental illness. Is like every time someone is anxious or sad or scared or lethargic or depressed, is there a root cause to this apart from the feeling itself every time? I don't think that it's obvious that there is. And then even if there is there some sort of like chemical solution to that? And that's not obvious. And so we have to, I think, like Justin was pointing out, move away from this idea that mental illness needs to be the same thing as physical illness in order for us to talk about it and work through it. I don't think it has to be that because it might not be that. That's the whole problem is it could be the case that every brain is exactly unique. And so that certain emotions that you feel are completely unique combinations that no one else will ever have to deal with before or after, and that there's no one way to fix it then. That's a possibility that is, it's something that's possible, even though that's not how it works with something like the flu. You know, not every flu virus is unique. Maybe it is in like marginal ways, but in the ways that count, flu viruses are the same and they can be treated the same. But that's maybe not the case with mental states. Maybe it is the case that like every case of depression is completely unique mm-hmm. and calls for a completely different solution. And this word that we use to describe these cases called depression maybe is a valuable taxonomy in some sense, but in another sense, it maybe overestimates our ability to treat these things as the same.
Yeah, and I'm really not sure how to frame this. I want to help some of the students that need to be just said, you know, work through it. We all have bad days, but I can't tell who really has mental illness that they're struggling with and those that are just having a bad day. The students seem to throw around the word depressed and depression differently than I would have ever done it when I was their age. And so that's where I think there's a decent fraction of students who probably don't have mental illness and would be better off coming to class rather than fighting their downtime staying at home. And I'm like, to me, it just seemed like a logical thing. Like, if you're feeling down today, probably not good to sit in your room and fester on it. This seems better, but I'm not a health professional. I don't know. So I really don't have those conversations with my students to say, well, buck up and come, you know, it's a good way to fight it. I don't know that to be the case. And I don't know who's fighting real illness or not. And so my problem with this mental health policy, the way it's grown, is that at the end of the day, are we going to be better off having it the way it is and the growth of it? Or would we be better off having it, let's say, siding on the everybody has to deal with mental illness? And you know, for the case of students, we think about the habits that they're forming. You know, when you go to a job and they're not showing up, they don't get raises, they don't, you know, they might get fired, whatever, first to go if they grew up in an environment where the parents and the high school and the college were all kind of, oh, this is what you do. You have a bad day, you just call a mental health day and you take a rest and hopefully it's better tomorrow. That's not necessarily going to work out in the real world as well. And so we're really providing a disservice to those who aren't on that. But I don't know if I've said much other than just kind of spewing my general little bit of frustration with it. Frustration on my part of not knowing how to help these kids better.
Yeah. Let me say a couple things. I think that both of you said things that are right and important. And when Peter's talking about the difference between physical and mental and talking about symptoms, like, just think about anxiety. Like, people can have anxiety. And to get to the point that, you know, these things might have totally different causes. You can imagine somebody having anxiety because they are very poor. They're very poor planners, and they haven't taken Russ's finance class, right? They don't know how to budget. They're constantly running out of money, and that might be why that might be the cause of their anxiety. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine somebody also being extremely wealthy and also having anxiety. Because maybe their anxiety comes from the fact that they can satisfy all their desires when nothing really seems to matter to them, and so their life doesn't seem to have any guardrails or something like that. And mm-hmm. It seems to me like giving both of these people just a pill to reduce their anxiety and just reduce that symptom, that's probably not the best way to treat these people as people, rather than if your goal was just to reduce the amount of anxiety in the economy or whatever.
Yeah.
It seems like the only way you're going to figure out what's actually going on in people's lives and what is causing what they see to be the problem with living their lives is by having a really deep conversation with them and figuring out, okay, in the first case, maybe what we need to do, this anxiety seems like it's all downstream from the fact that you can't plan with your money very well, right? Maybe if we treat that, this is going to go away as a symptom. You'll say something different in the second case. I also don't want to be taken as saying like this, you know, mental, we used to do it correctly and now we're screwing it all up. We used to do it very poorly too. If you look back in the 19th century, you can look at the way women who had what was then called hysteria were treated. So this is an exercise for the reader, because this is a family podcast. If you want to look at what how women were diagnosed with hysteria and then how they were treated once they were diagnosed with hysteria. And a clue is that hysteria and hysterectomy have the same root. You can then, you know, you'll figure out how they were treated. In the 19th century, when women had really severe anxiety, sometimes they were given what was called the rest cure, which was they just lock you up in a room and nobody can come and talk to you, and you just have to kind of rest for a long time and figure it out. And that actually didn't work for a lot of people. A lot of people found that really to promote their anxiety, their sense of disconnection, etc. And you can imagine that it probably worked for some people too. Mm-hmm. But you can see if some of these symptoms are going to be downstream of the things that's actually causing them, that's different. Men, on the other hand, got a different cure. They didn't get the rest cure. What they were most often prescribed was called the West cure, where they would send you out west a little bit and you'd go ride horses with your friends and do some fishing and try to get back to nature. That actually had a higher degree of success for things like depression. And you can imagine that being locked in a room probably isn't good for depression, but maybe going out and hanging out with your friends and doing some fishing is probably good for depression. But this is just to say, like, we aren't very good at treating these things. We don't understand what causes them at a systematic level. And it seems like the entire point of having a mental health apparatus or bureaucracy is to do the thing that Peter was saying is impossible to do, which is to come up with a one-size-fits-all solution for each of these diagnoses. And if we can see that these diagnoses, these symptoms, might have causes that are totally unrelated to each other, then once we set up this system, okay, well, Billy, this student Billy told his instructor that he's feeling anxious. His instructor is a mandated reporter, so he had to tell the student health center. Now the rule is that Billy has to come in and have two meetings with the mental health official, and then they're not allowed to practice because they had the mental health flag pulled, and we recommend that they go on trazodone or whatever. I don't know if that's even real. I think it might be, but
sounds familiar.
You know, this is going like you treating mental health issues like their headaches isn't a good way. Is just going to be not productive, and I think it's going to have way worse effects than doing things on an individual basis. However unscientific that may turn out to be, I don't think. One of the things that I've been saying is I don't think the study of mental illness is the same type of scientific study that the study of biological illnesses are. And so it's going to resist our attempts to come up with a kind of scientific if A then B.
Yeah.
And,
kind of reminds me a little bit of the science of physics versus the science of economics, that we don't have as much precision that we're working with when we're dealing with human beings and their behavior. So, all right, well, that looks like a good spot to wrap. Any other last thoughts?
I've got one, which is that if you can see this kind of thing happening and you can see these kinds of ratchets increasing, then I think that should make any parent much more skeptical of the apparatus that I think most of us grew up as thinking is a kind of fountain of objective truth. To realize, oh no, a lot of these people are just flying by the seat of their pants and they are literally reading from a script.
Right.
You are well within your right as a parent. And I think it is your moral duty as a parent to be very skeptical of these institutions and to realize that you're the one who is responsible for your child. And so I would recommend parents of children, you should get in the habit of publicly disagreeing with your doctor or questioning them. Because very often, and I think this is going to increase the more control bureaucracies have via insurance companies over what doctors can say, you are well within your rights to question the script that any of these experts are reading.
And what we've kind of worked through in the podcast, especially with regard to mental illness as opposed to disease and other germs, and that you should be at a higher questioning, heightened awareness for those sorts of issues than you would be for a normal doctor visit for a germ type disease. That there's better science on that side. But by the way, I was always impressed with my father-in-law, who he's the first person that I said, nope, I'm not doing that. Like, he's been in and out of hospitals. He's a paraplegic and he's had various complications and issues related to that over time. And right when I first knew him, you know, we'd be visiting him in the hospital for this or that. And doctor would come in and said, well, I think you should do this. And he's like, nope, not doing it. And I'm like, oh, you can say no to doctors? That was kind of interesting. And that was even on the physical, because he came to learn over time that they're kind of flying off the hip or reading a book or, you know, whatever. And so he was that knowledgeable about himself and the situation that he was more than happy to tell them no. So, all right. Well, this has been a production of the Gordon Institute here at Ottawa University. I'd like to thank you all for listening. 5-star rating helps other people find us. Otherwise, please forward this along to your friends and family via whatever message system you use. Other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.